Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to the LSE. I'm really pleased to be able to welcome you today and also to give you an indication of what our discipline is all about. You, of course, have some idea, but the idea of the sessions today is just to give you a bit more of an idea of how things are organised in terms of the teaching at the LSE. So I'm going to spend most of the time that we have now looking at this issue of punishment and imprisonment, which is an area really at the far end of the spectrum of social policies that are concerned with the way in which the individual engages with the state. It's at the more coercive end from, for example, education. And it illustrates many of the issues and challenges for social policy as a discipline in terms of the way we look at issues of inequality and also the way we focus on particular kinds of groups. And often there is an overlap between the groups who are most vulnerable to punishment by the state and also those groups who are vulnerable in other areas of social policy, so perhaps have lower levels of educational attainment, who suffer in terms of gaining participation in the labour market. So this is, as I say, at the far end of the spectrum of social policies. There'll be an opportunity afterwards to ask any questions, specific questions about the programmes that you've been offered a place on, or indeed any other questions that you might have. And after, we have an informal session where several of my colleagues who are involved in undergraduate teaching at the LSE will come, and they're available, as am I, to answer any questions that you have specifically about the teaching here. So this is very much the format of a lecture at the LSE, and for each of your individual courses, each week you would have a lecture of around 50-55 minutes, and at some point later in the week you would also have a class, and the class is much more about your participation and interaction. So it's more often in the classes that you have an opportunity to debate the particular issues, policy questions, concepts, theoretical ideas that will have been given in a lecture as a kind of overview to the topic. So what I want to do, first of all, is just to give you some indication of the way in which legal scholars have been concerned with questions of morality in relation to punishment. So what's trying to be achieved when we impose a punishment on an individual who's been convicted of a crime by a court, either by a magistrate's court or a crown court? So I'm going to say something about the goals of punishment. I'm going to say something very briefly about imprisonment in this country, and by extension the focus is on England and Wales because the Scots have a different criminal justice system, and then to answer the question, does prison work? And that takes us back into looking at the goals of punishment, what we're trying to achieve as a society when we impose a punishment, when the state imposes a punishment on an individual. And of course, the question of prison and imprisonment is often a kind of controversial area. It's an area that politicians are very concerned about, and essentially they're very concerned about presenting an image to both the public and the media which suggests that we are tackling crime, that we are engaging in a variety of control mechanisms which will reduce the crime problems in our society. And I'm going to question the role of imprisonment in that pattern of crime control. So, first of all, I'd just like you to... This is a question that is asked, or has been asked in the past, similar kind of scenario question, which is asked of the British Crime Survey. The British Crime Survey is a household survey that's conducted every year. Somewhere between 40 and 50,000 people are interviewed, and they're asked to tell the interviewers about their experiences of crime. That could be everything from having their been involved in some, perhaps having their car damaged in some way, right through to domestic violence. And there's also a part of the survey that asks people whether they've been involved in offending behaviour. So this is, and because the interviewers include all the crimes that have occurred, including those ones that haven't been reported to the police, it's considered by criminologists and social policy scholars as the most valuable source that we have to understand crime problems in our society. So this particular scenario has been given to respondents in the British Crime Survey. They are asked to decide what the appropriate punishment should be for an individual who's aged in their early 20s. They've pleaded guilty, so they've recognised the offence that they've committed. And the offence is a relatively serious one, burglary, and the victim is vulnerable, an elderly man, and the burglary occurred while the house was unoccupied. The offender had previous convictions for burglary, so he's not a first-time offender, and he took equipment, bearing in mind that this is an older question, so the equivalent today might be a Blu-ray player, so and a television, although, of course, as televisions have got bigger and wider, they're actually much more difficult for criminals to steal. But if you can imagine somewhere around perhaps a couple of hundred for the video, and what you're asked to do, and what I'd like you to think about just for a minute or two, is if you were sentencing this man, first of all, what would you be trying to achieve? What's your actual goal in punishing this individual in the sentence? Indeed, perhaps punishment wouldn't be your aim. So what are you trying to achieve? And I'd like you to estimate how many people you believe, bearing in mind that this is based on a true scenario delivered to 40,000 respondents, how many of those in percentage terms do you think would recommend a prison sentence? So just for a minute, just read through. A man, age 23, has been involved in a burglary, he's not a first-time offender, the victim was vulnerable. The first question is, what would you be trying to achieve? And how many of you would recommend a prison sentence? So let's start with the second question. Just with a show of hands, how many of you would recommend prison for this individual? Right, probably about a third of you. Okay, and for the whole group, what would be the purpose of the punishment? Those of you who've suggested that you wouldn't recommend a prison sentence, you would have the option of a community penalty, where somebody might be subject to probation supervision, they might be involved in unpaid work in the community, picking up litter, they might be involved in some kind of reparation or compensation to the victim, they might be fined. There's a whole range of sentences that are available to the courts. So for those of you who didn't recommend a prison sentence, what are you trying to achieve? What might you be trying to achieve when you suggest a sentence as an alternative to custody? Yep.
Yeah, I reckon I would get the man to repeat to some historical justice and actually see what the impact was on the elderly man. But I think, you know, many instances, like what we see here, is that he attacked opportunistically when the elderly man was actually out. And probably I reckon like a high likelihood that if the man had been in that, if he actually had to go through that, you know, human interaction, he would have carried it out. It seems to be someone who's doesn't necessarily want to experience or see what the impact is on a real person. Because I reckon the sort of adopted can also see, you know, where he has a health issue. Because, you know, he didn't really steal a lot of money and it wasn't a violent crime, so it's more opportunistic.
Okay, so because it's not a violent crime, so the assumption is that a violent crime is more serious, so he wouldn't necessarily be subject to a prison sentence. But what you'd be trying to do is to develop a relationship between the offender and the victim, in a sense, for the victim to be able to communicate how it's affected them, the harm level, but also with the assumption, I presume, that if an offender experiences the level of harm that they've caused, they might be motivated not to commit that kind of crime in the future. And there's also, if it was opportunistic, although a significant proportion of burglaries do occur during the day, when a house is unoccupied, so it's not necessarily opportunistic, but there are a whole range of crime prevention techniques that you might provide to the victim in order to prevent their further victimisation. Okay, well, in the survey, and it depended, where people weren't given any indication of the sentences that are available to the courts, 67%, so an opposite proportion, two-thirds, compared with the quick show of hands here, suggested a prison sentence. When people have more information, and some of those will have changed their mind and decided a community sentence was more appropriate. And this kind of sentence at the time, in the late 1990s, this individual would have gone to prison. He would have been sentenced by, he would have been moved up from the magistrate's court to the Crown Court, and he would have received a 12-month, the assumption was that amongst the people that answered the survey, they recommended a 12-month median term, those people that said that they, the offenders should get prison. In actual fact, he received a 2-year sentence. So this suggests a disjuncture between what the public assume in terms of what the powers are available to judges and magistrates. There's often an assumption that the courts treat people too leniently, but then we find when people are given an actual scenario, most members of the public are much more lenient when they have all of the information in front of them, are much more lenient than judges and magistrates are. So this suggests that courts are using harsher sentences than might be anticipated by members of the public. Okay, here's another scenario. Very, very common scenario for women's imprisonment. Have a slightly older Nigerian woman who's been recruited in her home country, carrying a moderate amount of cocaine. She carried it in a money belt. She was to be paid £2,500, which would be a very large sum of money in Nigeria. She was a single mother of 4 children who needed the money to pay off a debt to a moneylender. She would certainly receive a custodial sentence. What would you suggest would be the appropriate range? 1 to 2 years, show of hands. Okay. 3 to 5 years. Okay. More than 6 years, 6 years or more. Okay, very small number. So I think there was slightly more of you suggested a prison sentence of 0 to 1 years, and then the next option of 1 to 2. This individual would receive an 8 to 10 year custodial sentence. So again, the suggestion or the indication from just this exercise is that the courts punish and impose sentences that are much harsher than members of the public, you in this case, think are likely to be imposed, given information about the particular sentence. Okay, in terms of what we're trying to achieve, there are two broad camps in relation to jurisprudence and that reflect on the goals of punishment. The first is ultimately concerned with preventing further crime. So your suggestion that this individual should be involved in restorative justice, again, was an implication, a looking forward, not only focusing on the needs of the victim, but looking forward to thinking about trying to prevent this individual from committing crime again. So deterrence, we use punishment to deter people from committing crime. You might impose a particular kind of sentence on an individual who's been convicted, that specific deterrence where you're trying to, through the imposition of a sentence, you're trying to deter that particular individual from committing crime again in the future. General deterrence is where you and I are deterred from committing a crime because we know it has a long or harsh sentence. So deterrence is one of the aims, looking ahead to future consequences. The physical prevention of offending, when you incapacitate somebody, they're held, they're deprived of their liberty and they're held in custody, that's also, of course, physically preventing future crime from occurring whilst that individual is held in custody. Now, crime goes on in prison, there's lots of drug dealing in prison, there's lots of violence in prison, so there is still crime occurring, but members of the public are protected while that individual's in custody. And if we are seeking the reform of the individual, we're trying to rehabilitate them through perhaps providing some kind of education or training, meeting their mental health needs, then again, that's looking ahead to the future consequences. The alternative approach is much more concerned with the offender who's been involved in an offence, who's been convicted, receiving their just deserts. So this isn't looking to the future consequences, this is looking back. It's making the individual morally and legally culpable for the offence that's taken place. It looks back to the offence and argues that the only point of sentencing should be to look at the action that's been taken by the offender and to punish accordingly. And this suggests that it's important for society to denounce and to disapprove and to censure the individual. And the appropriate way of doing that is through imposing a sentence which takes account of the culpability of the offender. And so this is where we might see that a first-time offender who might have got, you know, a young person who gets caught up in some silly activity and then they're involved in a burglary or some kind of car crime should be treated very differently from somebody who's perhaps committed 35 burglaries in a year and who it could be considered to be a prolific offender. Now, what you're also trying to achieve, which is similar to the restorative justice suggestion, is somehow you're trying to restore the balance between the harm of the victim and the actions of the offender. So there is an attempt, albeit not necessarily a tangible attempt, to restore the balance between the harmed victim and the offender. So, just in a commentator in the US, DeLulio, just to make sure that these are clear in your minds, the first, the one that I've talked about last, is retribution, and this is where Peter is imprisoned, he's punished because of society's desire to do justice. We can also, and have done, talk about deterrence, so it's either about deterring, specifically deterring the individual, or generally deterring others. Rehabilitation, perhaps while somebody's in prison, they might participate in drug treatment or other programs that reduce the chance that the individual will return to crime when they've been released. Incapacitation, clearly when an individual is held in custody, they can't commit crimes other than against other prisoners, prison officers or visitors. These are the instrumental objectives of the prison service. We have a small number of prisons that are contracted out, but they're all governed by the same objectives, and the very first one is to protect the public, which suggests that incapacitation is a primary concern of our justice system. There are then concerns with how we keep, and again that's concerned with protecting members of the public by ensuring that there is a minimal or ideally no risk of escape. So prisoners are categorised according to their security risk. Then comes, third on the list, comes rehabilitation, reducing the risks of reoffending. And then there is the last objective is concerned with how the rights and the way in which prisoners should be treated, both humanely, decently, and importantly, lawfully. So this is what's happened to the prison population in England and Wales, and we can see a similar trajectory upwards in many other nation states. The US is perhaps had the starkest increase, but many nations have experienced increases in prison populations as crime problems have increased. And we know we've seen a steady increase in crime from the mid-1950s right through to the mid-1990s, and it was very steep from 1980 through to 1995. And we've seen a significant decline in crime for the last 15 years. And criminologists have been concerned with trying to explain the crime drop. And again, that's something that's been seen in many different jurisdictions, including the US. Okay, so this is, so we're looking at somewhere in the 80,000s of our prison population, and the projections are upwards to round about 95, slightly less than 95,000 for until 2016. How do we compare with other countries? Well, the median is 125 per 100,000 of each country's population. That's the median. We're slightly higher in England and Wales at 148. We're much higher than France and Germany, but we are significantly lower than the US. And the US incarcerates more per capita of its population than any other nation. And you can see how we compare with other formerly colonial countries, Australia and New Zealand. New Zealand has followed a very similar trend to England and Wales. So let's take a look. Does prison work? Let's try and answer this question. The pink line is showing the British Crime Survey trend in crime. So this includes all of the crimes that aren't reported to the police. We know somewhere between, and it varies across different crime types, people are more likely to report a burglary to the police or a theft of a car because they often need a crime reference number in order to claim on their insurance. So we see high levels of reporting of those kinds of crime. Bicycle theft, domestic violence, much, much less likely to be reported. If we look at crimes as a whole that can be compared between the data that the police collect and the British Crime Survey collects, it's somewhere around 50%. So half of the crime that is reported in the British Crime Survey never ever comes to police attention. So this is considered our best measure of understanding what's happening in terms of crime levels. You can see, as I said, the British Crime Survey has only been going since the 1980s, and we've seen a pretty steep upward trajectory and down since the mid-1990s. The second line is what's been happening with our prison population. So what does this graph suggest to you? Does it suggest that prison, increasing our prison population, is a useful way of bringing down crime problems? Yes or no, on the basis of this graph? So we can see that round about the time we increased our prison population, according to this chart, in the early 1990s, round about the same time is when we see a drop in crime. So this graph suggests that incapacitation, physically preventing people from committing crime, is a good way to reduce our crime problems. That's what we've seen, a drop in crime since the mid-1990s. The problem with incapacitation is, first of all, incapacitation is trying to take a slice out of a criminal's career. So by holding them in custody, it's trying to prevent the individual from committing further crime, protecting members of the public. The problem is that there are people who are held in custody who may already have decided that they want to turn their back on crime, and that's referred to as desistance, and they may be at the end of their criminal careers. So actually holding those people in prison is unlikely to affect our crime rates at all, because they've already made a decision to desist from crime. So even if they weren't in prison, they wouldn't be committing crime. So it's likely to have very little effect on our crime figures. Second of all, lots of people, or certainly some proportion of crime, involves co-offenders. So crime is committed by more than one individual. So it's only when all of those offenders are incarcerated that we can expect it to have any impact on crime. So co-offending is another reason why there might not be a straightforward relationship between crime rates and imprisonment. Thirdly, in relation to particularly street-level drug use, we know that as soon as an individual who's perhaps a runner involved in fairly low-scale dealing, as soon as they're taken off the streets and they find their way into prison somewhere, often for quite a short sentence, they're simply replaced by somebody else in that neighbourhood. So there is very little evidence that incarcerating individuals for drug crimes has any impact on drug transactions. There's every indication that you just simply have a replacement population. And then finally, young people are more likely to be involved in crime than people who are in their middle ages, and of course those who are more elderly. Because we recognise the harmful effects of prison for young people, they are less likely to be incarcerated at the early points of their criminal career. So again, if those people aren't physically prevented from committing crime, then we can expect it to have very little impact when those individuals are unless they're incarcerated. Okay, deterrence. This is an example of a campaign run by the Metropolitan Police a couple of years back. There's just a very short clip. Some of you will have heard it on the radio. It was playing on certainly most of the London-based radio stations at the time.
You have 6 new messages. One one girl? Oi, some proper bad boy joined me last night. He's called J-Man, you must have heard of him. Holler at me, yeah? Where you at? J-Man is proper on me. He's asked me to hide his strap. Well worried about it though. What should I do? Yo, I'm at the club with J-Man and his boys. Oi, I think there's gonna be beef because he asked me to bring his strap. Holler at me, see? God, J-Man just shot at someone. I'm gonna hide this strap at my yard. He says police will never come there. I'm scared, call me. Yo, the police is outside. J-Man ducked out and his strap's still here.
Wait, open!
They're gonna kick the door down, man. You gotta help me. Hi, it's me. The police have charged me possession because they found the gun in my yard. Girls get the same sentence as boys. I'm getting locked up for 5 years, girl. 5 years!
These messages were based on real-life stories. Hide a gun and you help commit the crime. If you have any information about gun crime but feel unable to speak to the police, call the Crime Stoppers charity anonymously on 0800 555 111. Trident. DropTheWeapons.org.
Okay, so that's an example of a public information campaign which is aimed at deterring individuals, in this case young women, for carrying weapons for their boyfriends, partners, whatever. And it makes the assumption that people listening to these kinds of advertisements might be less likely to commit crime when they know that actually they could serve a considerable amount of time in prison. Okay, and that makes common sense, doesn't it? That people will be deterred from committing crime if they know that there's a long sentence. The problem is the research evidence doesn't support the argument that deterrence has an effect. And there's two elements to this. First of all, many of you were surprised by the deterrent, by the length of sentences that were suggested when we did those two scenarios. So you can assume that many people, of course, why would you know exactly what sentence is available to the courts? Many people are unaware of the jurisdiction of the courts, the different guidelines for particular offences. So unless people know about it, then it's unlikely to have an impact. And as Bottoms and von Hirsch suggest here, if penalties are increased and potential offenders know this, and of course many don't, but even if they know this, the change will still have no deterrent effect if those persons do not fear the increased penalties or fear them but have overriding interests. So perhaps the burglar in the first scenario, even if he's aware of criminal the sentences, if he gets caught, perhaps he's got a drug habit and he needs money, he needs to fence the goods and he needs money to feed his drug addiction. So where people have overriding interests, financial ones or inclinations, addiction, favour and offending. And what's important here is the subjective character of deterrence is one of its most important characteristics. What the evidence suggests is that where individuals sense that there is a certainty that they will be caught for a crime, they will be detected, they're less likely to commit crime. But the actual sentence severity has very little impact at all. And the research has been based, has looked at the data in Sweden, in the US, and in the UK. And the same thing, the same pattern occurs in all of those jurisdictions. So certainty matters. Knowing that you're going to get detected might influence you, but actually the severity of the sentence, in the case of that young woman, would make very little difference to her in terms of 5 years compared with 1 year, or perhaps not even a prison sentence. So severity doesn't matter. And this is supported in other research evidence from the US. Just very quickly, the table is divided. It's based on different sentences across 45 US states from 1959 to 1987. And this shows on this side that there was, in more states, there was an increase for murder, rape, robbery, and assault. There was more of an increase in crime rates following the introduction of harsh sentencing in these states. So it was more common to see an increase in crime rates than a decrease. So again, this supports the idea that the actual severity of sentences makes very little impact in terms of deterrence. And again, that's kind of commonsensical. That's why, for example, you can have very high violent crime rates in the US, even where you have a large number of US states who have capital punishment. Hasn't had a deterrent effect in terms of violent crime. Okay, so what do we know in terms of rehabilitation? In the 1970s, there was a kind of sentiment that emerged after the work of a researcher called Peter Martinson, and his conclusion on the basis of reviewing lots of different studies about trying to prevent crime, trying to prevent recidivism, suggested that with few and isolated exceptions, the rehabilitative efforts that have been reported so far have had no appreciable effect. We know that specific deterrence is limited, and what's suggested by the review of evidence about what does work is recognising, first of all, that actually incarcerating somebody in prison can have criminogenic effects. So this depicted in this cartoon here. Prison works all right, that's where I learnt the business. So the idea, particularly if we send lots of young people to prison, they're interacting with criminal peers in the prison population, they're just as likely to come out knowing more about crime commission than the knowledge that they had when they went into prison. So there is a criminogenic effect of the prison environment. We also know that people that have a prison record find it incredibly hard, even if they've decided to desist from crime, to actually get employment. If they declare their criminal record, that will often prevent them from accessing employment opportunities. And when people don't have access to reasonable, useful, valid employment opportunities, that's again more likely to push them towards crime. And this introduces the idea of a revolving door to prison. People are released, they commit crime again, they go back in again. The research evidence on juvenile delinquency suggests less pessimistically than the Martinson thesis of the early 1970s. The more recent evidence suggests, and it's largely based on programs that have been evaluated in the US, that it depends on the intervention approach. If we try and influence people's cognitive behavioral skills, try and reduce their anger, try and increase their self-control, this can have some success in terms of moving people away from crime. But actually, the programs that people receive in prison, and in this country there are very few programs available that have a rehabilitative function, what's suggested is it's the much more therapeutic interventions and programs that involve, for example, counselling, that will actually have more of an impact than, for example, ensuring that somebody has to meet with their probation officer once or twice a day. So the more surveillant measures don't appear to have had very much impact on reducing crime. The therapeutic interventions, of which there are very few, seem to hold the most promise. And if we're comparing community sentences, community orders and suspended sentences, these generally have lower reoffending rates than those who are subject to a prison term. It's not a huge difference, but nonetheless, certainly short sentences, and if you remember the riots over the summer last year, many of those people who were convicted of offences will have received a short prison sentence. And we know very clearly that those short sentences have a desperate impact on individuals' possibilities of moving out of offending behaviour. They're not able to access programmes in prison. If they had a job, they're likely to have lost that job during their incarceration. And we are beginning to learn more and more about what tempts individuals away from crime. And it's very clear that that's a very individual decision, that people, you know, it's a kind of rocky road when people are moving out of crime. It's a bit of a kind of roller coaster. People fall off sometimes, they go back to committing some crime, and it's a process rather than a kind of light bulb moment when individuals decide that they don't want to commit crime anymore. very quickly, the retribution example, if you remember the just deserts model, instead of looking forward, because the argument is that actually it's not the court's business to determine what should happen to individuals. We can't predict what individuals are going to do in the future. So the proper role of the court is to look at the offence, to look at the harm it's caused, and to respond directly to that. That idea of retribution has been tested in a US study using... it's got a very low response rate, as is often the case with telephone surveys. But in this example, people were telephoned in Pennsylvania, and they were given two options. They were asked whether they will be prepared to pay $100 more in their taxes to either pay for rehabilitation to reduce youth crime, or alternatively, they had the option of paying $100 more a year for individuals to be held in prison for a longer period, to be held for 2 years instead of 1 year. And what this suggested, again, given that politicians, policymakers are very concerned with what the public think about in terms of crime control, study found that 72% agreed to pay for rehabilitation. That was more popular, and 59% agreed to pay more in their tax dollars for more prison time. And somewhere in between the two, there were around about two-thirds of respondents who supported early intervention, so working with people before they get involved in more serious crime. Okay, I just want to end with a Foucauldian perspective on punishment, which isn't concerned with the instrumental objectives that I've talked about, deterrence, incapacitation, rehabilitation. Foucault and other scholars, those writing at the moment, Loic Vacant writing at Berkeley in the US, David Garland, a Scottish scholar who's relocated to New York University in the School of Law, they're writing about a different function, a different role for the prison, which has its historical roots in what happened earlier in our history. And Foucault uses the idea, the metaphor of the panopticon, which was a prison design that was developed but rarely used. It was developed by Jeremy Bentham, and he was trying to look at ways in which we could hold people in custody, but where you didn't need large numbers of prison officers, which of course are very expensive. So he suggested this idea of a central tower with a radial configuration where people are held in individual cells all the way around the outside of the prison, and from the central tower, an individual standing in that tower can see into every one of those individual cells which holds a prisoner. Now, the kind of neatness of the idea is that whilst the people in the central tower can see into every single cell, those who are in those cells never know when they're being observed. They never know when they're being, because of the distance of the tower from the cells, people never know whether their behaviour is being observed. So they self-regulate. They discipline themselves. And that's the kind of neatness of this design. And Foucault uses that as a metaphor for the way in which punishment is delivered in late modern society. He talks about the regimes, the regimentation that we see in prisons. It's a very tightly constructed, controlled regime from when people are unlocked. The amount of time that they have to take a shower, make a phone call, all of that is very tightly controlled in the prison. And because of this idea of the panopticon, where people, the kind of all-seeing prison officer, people regulate their own behaviour. Foucault suggests that in the pre-modern period, when it was much more common for there to be public executions of people, where the state relied on what are now seen as very brutal punishments, where people would be tortured, they would be subject to violent hangings and various kinds of actions with the way in which their bodies were displayed afterwards. Foucault suggests that that was a way in which society, the state, was able to impose its jurisdiction on the individual. It maintained bodily power. In the modern, and indeed in the late modern period, that's changed. Now we have notions of rights. Individuals, if they're a member of a country, a nation state, they have citizenship rights. And because all individuals, at least in theory, have equality, legal equality, once they're represented as a citizen, Foucault suggests the state has introduced an alternative punishment, and it's introduced a different kind of institution. And the institution that we're interested in is the prison, but Foucault suggests that many of these arguments can apply to other kinds of institutions. Factories, not that we have very many of those anymore. There were certainly more of them at the time that Foucault was writing. Mental institutions, barracks, all of these other kinds of societal institutions are all concerned with regimentation, self-discipline. And the other element is, by classifying those people who are held in custody, held in prisons, held in mental institutions as, in many ways, being the enemies of the state, people who are committing crime against you and I, those individuals are differentiated. They're classified as problematic. They're classified as police property. They're classified as the property of the state. And the way, and so this represents another way in which the state can impose its sovereign power on the individual. Can't do it through public executions in the way it did in the pre-modern period, but the prison has come to serve that same function, Foucault suggests. And this is why prisons don't diminish the crime rate. They can be extended, multiplied, transformed. The quantity of crime and criminals remains stable or worse, increases. And that graph that I showed you, looking at the increase in prison and the crime rates, suggests that there is a decoupling of prison and crime rates. There isn't an automatic, direct relationship between the two. Foucault goes on to say, one should be surprised that for the past 150 years, the proclamation of the failure of the prison has always been accompanied by its maintenance. So you could go into the LSE library, you could look at a book on juvenile delinquency that was suggesting we needed to get tough with young people, we needed to make sure that they understood discipline and morality, they should serve long sentences. You could look at that book and see a book dated in the 1800s, not looking very different from a book that's been written in the 2000s. So there is a consistency in discourses around offending behaviour, and similarly Foucault suggests that despite our sense that prison doesn't work for all the reasons that I've discussed, nobody is actually talking about the abolition of the prison system. And it has this also this other attractive feature, which is it distinguishes the problematic members of our society who are often in lower class groups, often minorities. These are the people that are distinguished as delinquent, as different from the law-abiding community. And that continues, that idea sustains the prison as a holding facility for these people who commit crime against the law-abiding. So Foucault suggests perhaps the most important effect of the carceral system and of extension well beyond legal imprisonment is that it succeeds in making the power to punish natural and legitimate. We look to our politicians, we look to our policymakers, we look to the agents of the criminal justice system, prison officers, police officers, to protect us from those individuals who are involved in crime. That's why there was such an enormous reaction against what happened during the riots, was because the police were seen as no longer able to protect people, no longer able to protect small business owners, no longer able to protect even the larger companies, JD Sports, Currys, PC World, all of those shops that were so extensively looted in many urban areas. One last point is, as well as thinking about whether prison works, we also need to recognise that there is a whole social psychological literature on what happens to individuals when they're incarcerated, and indeed what happens to their families. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but these give you an indication of other factors that we need to consider when we think about the role of imprisonment in our society. And I go back to the earlier question that I asked. What are we trying to achieve? What are we trying to achieve when we impose a sentence on an individual? What are we hoping that prison will achieve? And is it enough set against the research evidence that suggests it's, you know, has limited effectiveness in many ways. And when we take account of all of these so-called pains of imprisonment, is it a cost that as a society we're prepared to pay? So there's very mixed evidence on incapacitation, deterrence and rehabilitation. Scholars like that have drawn on Foucauldian ideas suggest that actually the state has become very successful at managing those people who are seen as politically irrelevant. Often they're people that don't vote, the young, minority groups, those in lower social classes. All of these groups are of less interest to politicians for the most part. And again, I go back to the question, when we take account of all of the penal harms and their long-term effects, do we need to rethink the role of prison in our society? Okay, are there any questions about anything that I've said? That's an example of a lecture that you might attend on one of the social policy programmes. It's a very similar format used by my colleagues. And as I say, in addition to a lecture, you would have a class of no more than 15 students in which you would be expected to reflect on some of the issues that had arisen, for example, in this case, to think about the goals of punishment, think about what's the trade-off between incapacitation and rehabilitation. Those are the kinds of questions based on a reading, looking at the concepts or the goals of punishment, the policy solutions. All of those are the kinds of things that you would then discuss in a class in a much smaller group that would be facilitated by a member of staff. Okay, well, thank you for listening. I hope you have found it interesting. And for those of you that are able to stay, as I said at the beginning, we have an informal session now, which is on the floor below in room 205. And there's an opportunity to grab a drink and a biscuit and to ask any questions that you may have about the department.